Hello, and welcome to Conversations with Close, coming to you from the Great White North. I'm Michael Close, and I'm glad to have you with us. On this podcast, you'll hear interviews with magicians from around the planet. I try to ask questions designed to spark robust discussions, giving you information and insights you won't find anywhere else. If you enjoy these podcasts, I hope you'll stop by michaelclose.com and check out the products we have available. And now, let's get into today's podcast. My guest today on Conversations with Close is someone I'm sure well known to you. It is Piff, the magic dragon, who basically has taken the magic world by storm, coming to everyone's attention as a contestant on season one of Penn and Teller Fool Us, and then going on to headlining his own show in Las Vegas. And just recently, the author of a book, Piff, the Magic Book, Volume 1, ladies and gentlemen. So really, it's only going to be another 10 or 15 years, and we can all look forward to number 2. So I'm just really delighted to be able to spend a little time talking to this gentleman. Piff, welcome and thanks for doing this, man.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So the first part of the book, as those who have read the review that's also in my newsletter, in the newsletter will know, is, I think, one of the most valuable things that has been written about what it takes to actually succeed if you desire a show business career. And I want to spend some time talking about that. But perhaps for those of us, those who haven't read the book and who don't know, can you give us a little of your background, how you got interested in magic, and what your other pursuits were before you decided to make magic your career?
Yeah, when I was much younger, like 13, I think, 14, my friend started juggling. Then I started juggling. And then I found that I wanted to perform, you know, that I wanted to kind of like show people, which was, which was kind of a bit of a break from my normal personality, which was to be kind of shy and reserved. So anyway, I was performing as a juggler, and I just kept dropping these balls, and there's no way out when you drop something. You know, it's clearly you're wrong. And I started becoming aware of magic and seeing that these magicians who were like, you know, oh, something went wrong, but actually it turns out to be part of the trick. And I realized that magic, there are no mistakes. There are just different endings. So I switched. And, you know, when you're that age, you sort of, for me, I kind of got obsessed with magic and did practice it to the detriment of everything else, and soon found myself saying, okay, I want to do this for a living. I want to be a magician for a living. And my parents said, well, go to university first and get a degree, which I did, but I spent most of my time doing magic tricks in bars, so I got a very poor degree, which is not really useful for working. And I started doing magic professionally when I came back from university. But I was immediately struck by how, you know, I kind of dreamt of being in show business. I kind of dreamt of being like, you know, the magicians that I'd seen on TV and working comedy clubs and on stage. And the reality seemed to me to be working in bars and restaurants, and then you get the occasional corporate gig or wedding or bar mitzvah, and you know, there'd be the, like, once a year probably you get some celebrity party that you go and walk around and do a magic trick for a celebrity, and they'd be oh wow, it's pretty good, you should be on TV or whatever it is. But, you know, that just seemed to be everyone's kind of experience of a magic career. And I was like, oh, no, this isn't what I signed up for. I don't want to do this. And a couple of years after that, I was I was sick. I actually went back to working. I started doing computer science in the daytime. I was a third line support or something for a company. So I had a day job and I was doing magic at night, and I got sick, and it started getting quite serious. And I just, at one point, I thought, hang on a minute, I've spent all this time up until now living like plan B. Plan A was to go and do magic on stage and entertain ticket buyers. And somehow I kind of gone, well, I won't try and do that. I'll just do close up magic. And then when that wasn't much fun, I was like, well, I just have a day job, so then I can only do the close up gigs I want. And I realized that I hadn't ever like given it a go. So I got better, which took a couple of years, and I decided to go back to drama school, or to go back to go to drama school, because I had a bachelor's degree, but I was able to go to drama school and get a master's degree, and to try and give it my best shot. And ever since that moment, really, I've just kind of that's been the most important thing. It's not whether I've succeeded or failed. It's, did I give it my best shot?
The story of the dragon costume is kind of fun. You want to tell that one?
Sure, yeah. It kind of came out, it kind of, when I went back to do magic, when I went back to really try to make it work, I was running this magic-based theater company, and we were doing these magic plays, and they weren't great, really. Everyone else was great except for me. I was letting the side down. And at the same time, I was still reliant on these weddings and these corporate bookings for money, and I was just getting fired everywhere because I was just too grumpy. I was just like, and it was just my natural, it was just sort of like naturally who I was. And I'm sarcastic, and I'm, if somebody says something stupid, I'll make a remark about it. And so I basically got fired everywhere, and I was down to my last like two jobs. And my sister said to me, I've got a dragon outfit. I said, I need to go to a costume party. Totally unrelated to magic. A regular party. I said, I need a costume. She said, I've got a costume under my bed. I said, fine, I'll take it. Turns out it was a dragon costume under her bed. And I have no idea why she had a dragon costume under her bed. I don't think any of us need to know the answer. So I go to this party, and I'm the only one in costume. Nobody else is bothered. So I'm like, this is unbelievable. And then people were talking to me, and I was like kind of pissed. And because I was pissed, it was really funny. I'm in a dragon outfit. My friend said, you should do this in your act. You could be Puff the Magic Dragon. I said, wait, I could be Piff the Magic Dragon. You might have heard of my older brother, Steve. And I was like, that's pretty funny.
Yep,
I think
that's
that's
the
worth
line.
trying. I think that's worth trying. And I did it, not instantly, but a few months later. And as soon as I did it, I was like, oh, this is it. Because the theater stuff wasn't really working out. And I was trying to do stand up on my own, and that wasn't really working out. This, I was like, this is what I do next. So, I did one gig, and then I had to go to Dubai for 6 weeks and doing close-up magic, which is a pretty rough gig. And I spent all the money on that Dubai gig buying, my first Piff outfit, all of the props. And I came back, and that's all I did.
You know, the I've said to people, and about stage personas, that the people who do it best take some aspect of their personality and intensify it. when they get on stage. It may not exactly be who they are in real life, but they found this aspect. The problem with having an aspect of your personality being the grumpy, sarcastic, sardonic side is it's hard to be likable when you do that if it's just you out on stage. I mean, you know, and especially when you're doing magic, I think. I mean, you can be Don Rickles if your goal is to be funny, and everybody understands that. But when you're doing magic, where magic already has built in a certain amount of resentment that a number of people may feel about the whole thing, and then if you're kind of an asshole on stage at the same time, it makes the job tough. But the costume and the persona and the character, I think in your case, helps diffuse that a lot and makes it really palatable. I mean, they don't, you know, people are going to look at you and not go, "Oh, that guy's an asshole." They may go, "Well, that dragon's an asshole." But I think they understand the whole tongue-in-cheekness of the character because of the costume.
Well, I think it's difficult to punch down when you're in a dragon outfit, you know? And also, I try to keep it a justifiable outrage or annoyance. So, you know, if somebody does something, then I'll get annoyed at them and then I'll roast them. And then, you know, whereas just shitting on everyone is no fun for the audience.
Right.
You know,
right.
But, and also the other thing was that like, once I was able to get on stage, once I was able to find my way on stage, then over the years, the character kind of like rounded out and had those, you know, those other edges, the sort of like the more charming aspects and the sort of, what's that thing where you always lose?
Oh yeah. So it's a self-deprecating kind of thing. Yeah. Because and of course it doesn't hurt that you have a cute as hell dog with you,
right?
Which does soften everything, you know?
And that literally
was a jerk, but what a dog. Yeah.
That literally, I was in Edinburgh and I was doing my first year and I was, so much of this stuff just sounds ridiculous when I say it back. I was like, man, I really need a gimmick, you know, to stand out from all the other magic performing dragons. And I got to get something. I got to get something quick. But that was kind of my feeling with it. And I think, like you said, it's just like, hey, he can't be that bad if he looks after that dog.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You made a fantastic connection, and one that has lasted in the almost 14, almost 15 years since it happened. I think season one of Fool Us was 2011, something like
that.
A while 12 years ago. But making the connection with Penn and Teller, and of course you are constantly held up as, you know, one of the things that I deal with all the time is guys who are too much in their own heads about wanting to fool Penn and Teller. You know, I've got to fool Penn and Teller. And your name comes up as you know who the most successful person who's ever been on Fool Us has been? Mm-hmm. Piff. Shin Lim too, but you know. Yeah. But he doesn't have, you know, the problem with him is, and I got to level with you, he doesn't have a fucking dog. And if he had a dog, I'd probably feel better about his success. But, you know, he really needed a dog.
I agree. I think that was such a strange experience doing Penn & Teller Fool Us, because I'd be doing these theaters, you know, I was the middle act on a burlesque tour, an evening of burlesque, and it was 10 girls and a dragon. And I did 15 minutes in the middle, and I'd done it for like a year and a half. So I'd been touring every weekend these kind of large theaters, and it was great because I walked into the studio and I didn't feel like, I was like, okay, you know, I kind of felt at home in that many people, But originally, when I spoke to the company, they said, we want you to do this thing where you levitate Mr. Piffles. And I was like, well, no, because it's not gonna make Penn and Teller think. And I don't think it is about, I don't think you have control over what fools Penn and Teller, and therefore there's no point worrying about it. But I do think that if you're gonna go on that show, you should at least make them think,
I agree.
So I said, I'm gonna do this trick and let's see what happened. And it was a trick that I'd come up with a few years before. And it was the one thing magicians were like, wow, that's pretty clever and fooling. So I was like, if they figure it out, fine. If they don't, then great. But they figured it out. Well, kind of, we still had this fight. Penn and Teller and I, we still have an argument where I say they busted me and they say they didn't. This is the new, they say, no, we misunderstood. And I'm like, no, I think you figured it out. But I remember coming off stage and going, I actually, it turns out I'm really bummed out that I didn't fool them, because there was a moment when I did, there was a moment when I did fool them both. And then Penn just said, so to Penn, so, okay, we don't know what it is. I'll just make up a random thing. And Penn made up a random thing, and it wasn't like a million miles away, and I couldn't say no. But then Teller sort of like started working it out. And so because I got close to it, then I started feeling, I might fool them. And then I was disappointed afterwards. And again, you talk about these, the ups and downs. You never know what's an up and you never know what's a down. You just never know. Because, I went backstage and then they called me a car and it immediately whisked me away. 10 minutes after I was on stage, I was back in the car going home. And the next day they said, Penn and Teller want to meet you, but I was already at my next gig on the other side of the country. So I didn't meet them for 10 months, and that bit didn't come out for like 3 or 4 months. And when it came out, it was incredible. I was with two of my best friends and my girlfriend at the time, and they showed it, and then my phone just exploded. Just text messages, because my phone, I was like working as a juggling close-up magician, so my number was on my website. So email, just pouring in emails, just pouring for days, and it went on for days. And I got my first agent from that spot, and everything that's happened came from that one spot.
Amazing. And you had it, well, everybody on season one had it rugged because, as I've said to people, that whole process, the whole what I call the bust process, when Penn and Teller are talking, when Penn's talking to you, that has gotten refined over, 10 seasons that we've done. And it puts much less pressure on the performer to have to try to feel like they're fielding Penn's comments and trying to, it's like the performer has to figure out whether or not or they were fooled, and now that doesn't happen, and it's much more comfortable for everybody. But it certainly springboarded, but things were not, I mean, you had to do an awful lot of other work between that and getting signed up to do a Vegas show. I mean, I'm curious about the time you spent with Mumford and Sons. Mumford and Sons? Mumford and
Mumford and Sons.
yeah,
Yeah,
Mumford
Mumford and
and
Sons.
Sons. So was that those big arena performances? I mean, how many people are
Well, I
you
did,
doing magic
right.
for in a thing like that?
I mean, I did this theater tour with them, which is like 1,500 to 3,000 people, and killed. Every gig just killed. And they loved it. And they were like, hey, come and play the arenas with us. And I really needed the money. So I went to Newcastle. It was the first one. And I immediately knew I was screwed. Because a lot of bands have an A stage when they play arenas. They have an A stage, which is at the front that everyone looks at, and they have a B stage, which is in the middle of the arena. And Mumford and Sons had this set up. And they said, what you're going to do is you're going to perform in the B stage while we set up for the bands. And then when the band's ready, the band will start. And then we'll throw back to you when the band's finished, because they have like three or four supporting bands.
I see.
And I was like, this is a terrible idea, guys. Oh, this is a terrible idea. And so the first night, and the first, oh God. And when the doors open, the fan, that's when the super fans come in, but that's not when the crowd arrives. The crowd arrives 10 minutes before Mumford and Sons are going on stage.
Yeah.
So, I was like just literally in a sea of no one with like maybe like 200 people at the end of this arena. So I was doing, I was doing my act, and I would going through every bit, every bit, and the crowd kept building, and eventually there was a natural crowd in the room. And it was at that point in my act, which, and I stopped doing this now, and I talk about that in the book as well. But I broke, I used to do a bit where Mr. Pibbles gets a trick wrong, so I broke his leg. And as I did that, I just about got the attention of all 19,000 people. And they all turned around to me and they were like, whoa, terrible dragon. So the first night in the arena, I was just miserable. And the band were like, wow, they didn't like you, did they? And I did 10 more of these arena dates. And I reckon about five of them went great. The crowd could see me. We changed things around after that. The crowd could see me. They laughed what I was doing. It was good. But man, that first gig was just like was a nightmare. And so I did that tour, but you just never knew whether I was going to go out on night. I was going to go out that night to apathy or to anger, or I was going to go out and it was going to be a great gig.
Wow.
So I kind of went, I don't like living like that. I want some of this to be in my control, and
Yeah,
none of it was
well,
in my control.
that's a lot of anxiety to be facing on a regular, and it's not like, gosh, I hope the kids at this bar mitzvah like me. It's like, geez, I hope these 20,000 people don't, storm the castle.
And it's one of those things that I also like. I'm a big fan of, if you do a gig and you bomb, then go back and do it again until you can get it right.
Yeah.
I'm a big believer in that. But this was like every night, it was just the conditions were completely different. It was like 10 separate, completely different gigs.
Yeah, well,
So there was
and there's no way to adjust. I
no.
mean, you can adjust for what happened the night before, but if it's all different in the next arena that you go in and the whole situation is different, then that adjustment is meaningless. And you're back to being panicked again every night. That's no fun at all. That's no fun at all. I forget who used to tell the story about opening for Richie Havens, but it was a you know that the crowd is there. They've timed their drugs properly, and this comedian is supposed to come out before Richie comes out. And the crowd is going, Richie, Richie, Richie. Now, I don't know if it was Shandling or who it was who used to tell this story, but he gets up to the edge of the stage and the stage manager looks at him and says, your name, Richie? And he says, no. He goes, they're gonna kill you. So, you know, it's that kind
Yeah.
of thing. I mean, it's so difficult, so difficult.
Yeah.
So how did you make your way to Las Vegas then?
There was a casting director who had seen me and sent the, he'd seen me live, and then he sent the Fool Us tape to a company called Spiegelworld, who had a big show called Absinthe. And they were looking to do the next show. So this guy says to me, "Oh, I'm coming to Australia, where I was doing my hour-long show. I want to talk to you about doing a Vegas gig." And I was like, "This is ridiculous." So I met him. He saw the show. He had a good time, and I absolutely just was like, "It's never going to happen." And I'll just ask for what. One of the other things I think it's pretty important to ask for what you want, as long as you have realistic wants. There's no point asking for, I mean, I heard of like a TV magician who refused to do a second season until they gave him a black Rolex. And it's just like, well, why don't you just do the season and buy a Rolex? And, you see this in sports a lot as well. People are like, but if you have realistic wants, like, hey, I want to do a show with my name on it. Then it's good to just ask for that stuff, because it's not, nobody is trying to get it to you. There's nobody sitting at home going, "God, Piff the Magic Dragon. I want to make a show with that guy. You know what? I'm going to beat down his door to make it happen." It's like one of my friends says to me, one of my friends said, "There's a lot of people who believe they're a genius, and they're just waiting for someone to knock on the door." And I thought it's so true, because the one way to find out if you're a genius is to open a door, go out there and perform, and you soon, well, I soon realized I wasn't a genius. And my other friend said, I really wanted to be in this show, called La Soiree. And she said to me, "Well, have you asked?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, what's your plan?" I said, "Well, I'm just hoping to, like, you'll see me one day and be like, 'Hey, come and be in my show.'" She was like, "Just ask." So I asked, and a couple of weeks later, he's like, "Hey, somebody dropped out of the show. Can you do it?" And I did it. And it was a big lesson. So I asked for all these things, and amazingly, they agreed to them all. And you also get treated more seriously if you ask for things. If you just kind of say, "Oh yeah, that, oh wow, this is amazing, I'd love to do it," then you're not going to get treated that well, I don't think. If you say, "Okay, I'd love to do this, but here is what I want and need to do, in order to do this to the best of my ability," then they suddenly go, "Oh, okay, well, we better make this happen." Because they're spending the money either way, and if you're turning up and you haven't asked for everything, and you're miserable, or you can't do what you think it's a, it's a different gig than you thought it was going to be, or whatever it is, if you haven't put in the foundational work, then you're in trouble. And I found that out myself a couple of times. So anyway, I did that. And I ended up in Vegas, much to the surprise of everybody. There is a story that I didn't put in the book, but I was seeing this very nice girl called Sarah for about 4 or 5 years. Really great. And her parents hated me, just hated me. And they were very rich, very wealthy, and so they were making our lives difficult. So I took her mother out for lunch, and I said, "Hey, I just want to see why you know, what the problem, what the issue is, and if I can help, because, me and your daughter are obviously very happy together, and this could go on a long time, and it'd be great if everyone was happy. We had this lunch, and she turned around to me and she said, "This is unbelievable." This was like, maybe like 6 months before Flawless or something. She turned around to me and she said, "We think that you're very talented and you're really good at your job, and you're going to get more and more successful, and you're going to land your own show in Las Vegas, and you're going to move to America, and you're going to break our daughter's hearts." And I said, "If I can promise you one thing, it's that I will never, ever have my own show in Las Vegas. So I don't think we need to worry about that." And almost 10 years later, here we are.
And did you break your heart? Is that it? Is that the confession?
We both kind of realized that we wanted to go in other directions, so we remained friends. It was a mutual understanding. But yeah, that's I did this show, and then it crashed and burned. But I when I arrived, I could see that they'd overspent on their budget, and they'd overspent on talent, and there was no way this was going to make money. So I straight away got a green card, or applied for a green card, and I straight started making my plan B. And so about 7 months later, they cancelled the show, and I had some savings, and I just was like, "Okay, I'm going to stick it out. I'm going to see if I can find a way to stay in Vegas and make this happen." And that way turned out to be America's Got Talent.
I'll touch on one other one of the things that, of course, is part of the game when it's your show, when you're the star of the show. My wife Lisa saw you in Niagara Falls
Oh yeah.
recently. When
Yeah, she didn't see me on my best day, to be fair.
No, but an interesting day. Simply because, you had food poisoning and
I had this weird food poisoning that I got like on the it was a 3 day gig, and I got it on the first day, and it just got worse. And by the I think that was the final show, and by the final show I just barely move.
crazy, crazy. But you got to get through it. But you got to get through it. You've been doing quite a bit of little hit and run outside gigs. I think that's a good thing. I mean, one of the problems with Las Vegas is always that people come to the town and then don't recognize any other than a huge headliner, who's maybe like a Celine Dion or somebody like that. They look around and they don't know any of the acts there. So it's I'm sure it's a smart business move to be doing these other casinos and these other venues around the country and around North America, because then if they see you, and if friends come to Las Vegas and see your name, they go, "Oh, that's that guy that Betty and Jack had such a fantastic time seeing." But I'm sure that's also a challenge, moving your crew and your people from point A to point B.
It's like, I mean, the job is like 90% logistics and emails and 10% on stage. So, well, maybe 5% on stage and 5% creating. But we still tour a lot because it generates new material. We do a different show on the road. You always, this that's the one thing in the business you need. Is you need to have the next trick out your sleeve. And it stops everything from stagnating. So I love touring, yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the creating part, because in the new book, the opening I don't know, 40, 50 pages. And by the way, for the people who haven't seen it, it's an absolutely beautiful book. It is full of just wonderful color photographs. I was amazed how beautifully that all worked out. I mean, it's really a, you know, it's a great looking book. And
yeah, there's a good team. There's Andy Gladwin, who did the layout, and a guy who works for me called Zach Beyer, who took all the photos, and Gabriel, who makes all my props, my costumes. He also, like, you know, would rebuild stuff that we hadn't used for a while.
Ah.
So yeah, they did a good job.
But the interesting thing about the tricks part of the book is that you are basically revealing what were the core effects of your act for many, many years. And you do say in that that, you know, these are things that for the most part I've moved beyond these to, you know, other things, although you do mention that there's a few that are still in the show. But it's rare for a professional to give away, you know, not, I say give away, there's you know, there is a purchase price involved, but the tricks that, you know, that they have used. And, you know, the first question, you know, because I'm very interested, you know, when I get around to figuring out what angle I'm going to take when I review a book, I sort of like to see what other people are saying about it and what people are talking about it. And it amuses me when someone asks, are there tricks in there that I can use, that I can do?
Right.
And of course, the answer is no, absolutely not. Unless you're going to buy a dragon costume and a chihuahua, no, there's not tricks in there. It's not like Carl Fulva's self-working card tricks, where you're going to buy that book and you're going to probably find a dozen things that you can pick up a deck of cards and do for your friends. But to me, that isn't the point of these tricks. That's not the point of even studying these tricks. The point for me is to see how a professional takes a concept and it eventually becomes a performance piece. And, you know, everybody, you know, this is always one of the reasons why those who get ripped off by people who see a performance and go, oh, I'm going to do that, why there's such anger from the performer. Because the people who rip off don't understand the length of time and, it, you know, the pain and heartache it took to bring something from point A to point B. So, no, you're not going to do any of these tricks, but are you going to learn something important that you can use as you work on your own stuff? You know, absolutely.
And also there are things, there are little, I didn't underline them too much because they are actually, they're principles that I still use, but there are little things that we come up with, and I'm like, oh, that you could do that. Like, I'll just talk about one here. We load a as a trick. Well, I used to do it with a fortune cookie, and it's like a nest of boxes. It's a nest of boxes, and the last thing is a ball of ribbon. And inside the ball of ribbon is a final box. And inside that, there used to be a fortune cookie. And we still do a trick with a fortune cookie. So I'm like, I explicitly say, don't do that. But one of the nicest things about that is the load tube is a poster.
Mm.
So as I go to load it, I just drop the object into the poster, pull out the poster, open it up, give it away. And now there's no evidence of how you loaded the box. So, you know, now there's definitely no point in that. That whole trick was, you're going to get nothing back from learning that trick step to step, step by step. But you know, if you have a situation where you need to load a box, then you go, oh, hang on a minute, I could use that poster idea. So that was like what I thought was useful about the book. The other thing is most of the material is it has enough flesh on it that it's tied to me as a performer. And what I mean by that is Jeff Hobson, For some reason, unknown to me, sells, well, probably for money, I would imagine, sells egg bags and sells his routine. Now, Jeff Hobson, you can't go on stage and be like Jeff Hobson.
No.
You should not do that. That's like a
Right.
very, there are other performers who are more neutral, who they're almost like presenters of magic.
Right.
But Jeff is a character. And I saw this guy in Australia do Jeff Hobson's act line for line, word for word, gesture for gesture, the whole like drop some cards, get making a guy bend over, making comments on the guy. And he was wearing a short sleeve white shirt, a black tie, and some black slacks. And he could not understand why he was not getting the laughs. Jeff Hobson wasn't. And it's just like, it would kind of be hilarious. We just did a book launch, so we to show that you could do this material, I had my friend Paul DeBec do an act called Paul the Penguin, and he had a quackula instead of a tacula, and he did and he had a dog in a penguin outfit, and he did the dog food trick. So yeah, sure. I mean, you could do it if you need to, but
Yeah,
I think
it's not.
slowing your progress down by doing that.
Yeah, and it certainly isn't the point. I mean, for example, the loading with the poster. There's a very sneaky aspect of trick construction where you say, well, wouldn't it be great if you just produce the gaff? I mean, there's a trick like that. John Carney has a trick where he has a I forget exactly what the whole situation is, but he ends up producing several half dollars or silver dollars. And the holder that keeps the coins separated and ready to be produced in a handy sleight of hand way is a folded up $20 bill, which ends up in the fold has compartments where you can put these coins. So basically, it's the gaff, but at the end of the trick, you actually produce the 20 as the last thing in it. I mean, and this is the same idea. You instead of thinking it as a gaff, you think what other things in the world could be used as a slide to take something from point A to point B, and then how could that be, displayed in a natural way? And those are the kinds of things, I know that I'm a little more attuned to looking for that kind of thing when I read a book of tricks.
That's why I want to get. That's like when Mike Caveney put out his Book of Wonders, and I was like, and that's a very similar situation to this. It's like he wrote every detail of it, but he was like, I mean, he was like, look, if you really need to do this shit, then do it. But I don't know how you're going to do it.
Right.
But he had a design for a stool that would hide his chicken.
Oh,
We
right.
took elements of that design and we made a chair for Mr. Piffles that is unbelievable. And so I like that aspect of sharing, that's sort of like paying back the debt that
Sure.
that, look, this tiny bit of this routine may be useful to you. Don't do the whole thing, but this tiny bit may have some use.
Yeah. And it's simply a hard lesson to convey to magicians. I suppose the one trick that would be most easily used by the average magician is the card thing, which is I think the last trick in the book. I mean, it has all those beautiful. I don't think I've ever seen a book where each page is devoted to one move of the thing. But that's a trick that isn't so tied to the piff personality that it couldn't be used by somebody else. Well, I think my hat's off to you. I'm a big fan, number one, and we've come over the last few months, and the fact that you and Mac were on Fool Us together, so we've had a chance to interact you and I a little bit more. And I really enjoy our interaction, and I enjoy your company, and I enjoy seeing the way that your mind works. I think the book is great, and I think there's a certain amount of a feeling of lightness that comes from taking your children and letting them go out in the world and, you know, have their lives of their own. And that just opens up some space where you can let some new things come in, and you see where those things go. So it's always a fun thing. And it's always interesting, you know, in my case, to see what magicians who, you know, what they find interesting. You know, Jorge Blas took the Frog Prince and turned it into a stage trick, which I thought was really an amazing thing. And, you know, just to see what people do with it. And it's a lot of fun. Sometimes you see guys who take it and you go, well, I think you missed the point on that trick, but that's okay. You know, but you know, that happens every now and then. I got no fault with
that. I think also, like, it's nice to get to a point when you're like, hey, do what you want. I'm doing fine, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I don't put on a dragon costume. Don't buy a chihuahua. But, you know, knock yourself out. Have a lot of fun.
Knock yourself out, yeah.
Piff Man, it's always a delight to talk to you, and I wish you great success on the book. And as always, I look forward to talking about things that you're coming up with. And
And we're going to – hopefully we'll start working together again now, because I don't know whether your listeners know this, but you are one of my top three magic consultants in the world, I think, working today.
That's very kind.
You know, we work with a lot of consultants, and it was only recently, wasn't it? Only this year we started working together.
Working together, yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, the stuff that we've got out of it, and you've moved along, you know, you move things, projects along to a fantastic new level. So, yeah, I'm sure we will be speaking soon,
absolutely,
whether you like it or not.
Yeah. No, well, I look forward to it. I always do. My friends, stay well, stay safe, stay away from food poisoning. And thank you so much for being with me today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.
This has been another Conversation with Close. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, please be sure to tell your friends. Like us on Facebook at Michael Close Magic. Follow us on Twitter at Mike Close Magic. And visit our website, michaelclose.com. If you'd like to help support these podcasts, you can do that at anchor.fm/Michael Close. In that way, we can continue to bring you high-quality content. Until next time, so long from the Great White North.